Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. It's free, and they have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. And you can also make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Carrie Gillen.
And I'm Megan Figueroa.
And today we have a few housekeeping items before we begin. So the first thing is we recorded this episode during the Linguistic Society of America, or the LSA conference this year. And so It was in a hotel room. So the sound quality might be a little off.
Yes. We were sitting around a table in a hotel room, and it was freezing outside.
That day it was not yet freezing. Later, it did freeze. It did snow.
Yeah.
Which was exciting for those of us who live in the desert.
Yeah. And who didn't have altitude sickness and was stuck in the hotel room all the whole day. Anyway.
Yeah, so this episode is going to be more like what our bonus episodes are going to be like, and that gives us the opportunity to talk about our Patreon.
Yes, so we joined Patreon, and we already have a few subscribers.
Yes, so thank you, Anne, Daniel, Lingthusiasm, and Suzanne.
Yeah, so thank you so much.
So there are three levels. If you are able to support us, we would love to have you as supporters.
Yes.
We have a $1 level, which is... we just thank you for supporting us. We have a $3 level where you get a sticker. Your name is announced on the air. And then we also have a $5 level where you get the sticker, your name announced, and also you get access to the bonus episodes. So this episode is kind of in the vein of what those bonus episodes are going to be like. And we are going to record a real bonus episode this month about Word of the Year, which was part of the LSA as well.
Yes. And the sticker that you get features the adorable fries. It's very cute. I think we tweeted it out, right? A picture of the sticker.
I think we did. If we didn't, shame on us.
Yes. it's very cute.
Yeah.
So
so this episode we had a chance to interview the Lingthusiasm hosts, Gretchen McCulloch and Lauren Gaughan, which we all pronounce incorrectly because we don't have the correct vowel.
Yeah, but she's nice and says that it's okay to pronounce it like gone as a gone girl.
Yes. So we also want to tell everybody that most of our episodes are on YouTube now. So if you prefer to access episodes that way, or if you know people who prefer to watch a video as opposed to listen, you can do that. And we're also slowly adding transcripts for our episodes. We don't have a paid transcriptionist, so we're just doing it ourselves. And so it'll take a long time, but we are slowly adding them. And our first one is up.
Yeah, and we're very excited about doing that because we are, of course, really trying to make this as accessible as possible. And ultimately, I think a Patreon goal of ours is to pay someone to do it.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So bear with us. Carrie did the first one. Thank you so much, Carrie. but yeah, it's definitely a goal.
Right. And we also want to remind people of our email address, vocalfriespod@gmail.com. Okay. So now we have an interview with Gretchen McCulloch and Lauren Gaughan of Lingthusiasm.
Is really exciting. We are sitting in a hotel room with the Lingthusiasts.
The Lingthusiasms?
I don't know. Do you...
The co-hosts of Lingthusiasm?
Oh, but that's too long.
I like Lingthusiasts.
We call our listeners Lingthusiasts too, but that's good.
Can you and your listeners be the same name?
I don't know.
I think it's okay. Okay. I mean, we're all on the same level. We're all people.
We're all friends here.
All enthusiastic about linguistics.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. So we have Gretchen McCulloch.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
I'm more enthusiastic about that.
No, it's because I was staring at you to see if I said your name right.
Yeah, I say McCulloch.
Okay. Yeah. Because other people, there are other...
People say McCullough, but like, I don't know, it's complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we have Lauren Graham.
For such a short name, my name is complicated. It's Lauren Gorn.
I say, I don't have that.
I was never going to get there.
So
you can say Gone, like homophonous with G-O-N-E is okay. Fine as
like
well.
Like Gone Girl, like Ben Affleck?
Yeah, that is me.
Okay.
Yeah, I say Lauren Gone and she says that's okay.
Lauren Gone. But yeah. it's the sound in like, what?
It's the open O.
Okay.
Which we've talked about before.
We have talked about
this. And none of us, except for Lauren, have that one.
Yeah. So. And she's Australian.
Yes. So Gorn and Gone are two. So Lauren Gorn watched Gone Girl. They're two different vowels for me.
For you, but not for us.
But I'll make it easy for you.
Thank you.
I can't unmerge just for you, Lauren.
Yeah. Unmerge on that one word only.
Yeah. So today we're going to talk about American and British hegemony?
Sure. Well, we were actually just going to suggest that we talk about Australian and Canadian English, because they're the Englishes we speak and have the most experience
with. Yeah. So the American is outnumbered this time.
Yes. I mean, as we should be. I mean, we're really fucking things up.
I forgot to ask if this podcast had swearing.
Oh, yes.
Totally. Oh, yeah.
We have the explicit rating. It's all good.
Yeah. I mean, our taglines, don't be an asshole. Even just with that, we get an E.
There is that.
Yeah.
That thing.
So. Well, yes, then, like all of our other episodes, I will probably learn the most here.
This time, definitely, I think. All right. So where did you guys want to begin? What...
I think we want to begin with keyboards because that's where a lot of our frustration manifests. Mm. So when you have to select in like a spell checker on a document, it's almost always, do you want British or American English, as though they are the two. And even if you choose something like Canadian or Australian English, often it's like it was made by someone who has never actually spoken to a Canadian or an Australian. And there's kind of some of it is like orthographic convention stuff. So it's the... You know, we both use ISE instead of IZE.
Oh, I use IZE a fair bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's this whole other diglossia thing we can get into.
In terms of, like, Canadians use Z, but in terms of words like realize or analyze, I would tend to use IZE. Mm-hmm. But when I choose Canadian English from a spell checker, it will try to correct me to ISE on those words. Mm-hmm. But you get the opposite, right?
So Australian English follows British conventions in this regard, but on a lot of spell checkers, if you tick Australian English, they'll tell you that it should be IZE, and it's like, no.
Interesting. I didn't realize that.
So there's like this kind of like delocalization problem where they're like, if you pick Canadian English, it just maps you onto British English instead, or vice versa for Australian English.
Wait, and that's going to be widespread in Australia that you use the S?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So there are not people that some of them use Z.
No. I mean, unless I'm writing for an American publication, right. And then I will tailor it, you know. So I think we become very good, and I've noticed that's a thing Canadians do as well, is flipping back and forth between.
Right. Yeah, like I would use both depending on who I'm talking to and what I'm feeling like. And I feel like spell checkers don't reflect that stylistic choice. They're like, you must pick a thing and do it. And like, some words I'm more likely to use ISE on, and some words I'm more likely to use IZE on, and I'm okay with that.
Or it should just figure out, in this document, I'm clearly writing for an American audience, and it's going to be IZE throughout.
Yeah. We run into this problem, so we also have a podcast, as you well know. So we do our captions we do transcriptions for the podcast, and we do that by uploading our episodes to YouTube, and having YouTube's auto-captioner figure out what we're saying in a very bad version, and then we have a human go in and edit that rather than have a human try to do it all, so it's faster that way. But we have to pick a language that it thinks the talk is in.
Right.
And our choices, you know, along with a couple other languages, French and so on, we can pick between British English and American English mm-hmm. in a show that's hosted by a Canadian and an Australian. And what we'd really like to be able to do is say, A, there are two speakers here.
Yes.
One of us has ours and the other one doesn't.
Yes.
two speakers of two very different dialects of English.
Two very different dialects. And, you know, maybe you could detect two different voices because our voices sound fairly different. And then also to say, and you should be mapping us onto two different standards. Because if you, you know, for me, if I think American English, it's like mostly okay. Yeah. But for you, you're going to get a better job with British English because he doesn't expect you to have R's.
Yeah, and look, I should point out, like, we both speak highly standardized, highly educated varieties of the English that we speak. And in terms of the scale of linguistic discrimination, we are not really, you know, complaining about IZE over ISE is not really the kind of discrimination that a lot of people face and is, like, really bad. But it's really frustrating to be invisible in global English, and you see, like, if we can't even get people talking about more than British and American English, okay. how are we going to get people to talk about kind of lower status varieties of British English or varieties of American English that are negatively stereotyped? If we can't get people to think more broadly about the varieties of English that there are,
or Indian English or Singapore English, or
You know, like South African English is mm-hmm. a whole other, like...
South African.
And, like, there's lots of Englishes, and other languages are also multi-pluricentric, mm-hmm. you know? So this is a problem that comes up with French in particular, because I live in Montreal, mm-hmm. and French has this very high prestige associated with, especially, you know, Parisian French or European French. And so, like, Montreal kids get, you know, Quebec kids get taught in schools European French, because that's, like, the better French.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, kids in a lot of, like, the former French colonies get taught, like, France French, even if the French that's spoken there is a very different variety. And so, like, French, you know, English has two centers.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
Yeah.
And French only has one, and that's also a problem. Like, a lot of the, you know, Spanish is very different in very different countries.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of the languages that we think of as, like, major world languages are actually have more complexity than we think of them.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. The two things have already come up that we've talked about before. So the AI, automatic speech recognition stuff. So we talked about that with Rachel Tatman
mm-hmm.
and how, and what she was looking at with the YouTube comments was just gender and how women's voices are less well transcribed. And then we also talked about Canadian French in our last episode.
Oh, yeah. She's so great.
She is. Anyway.
Well, this reminds me that I guess it wasn't too long ago that the Microsoft Word added grammar as one of the things that it'll underline for you.
Wait, that's not new.
Is that new?
No.
No. Like in the last 10 years.
No. The whole time I've been using Word, it's had it.
It's just that you automatically disable it because it's so terrible.
Oh.
It used to be worse. Now it's...
So maybe I got a new computer and then it had it again.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's probably
all right. Well, we solved that mystery. But, okay, so if we're thinking about the grammar, like, what if you use double negatives? Or what if...
You use the passive. Uh-oh!
Yeah, yeah. Because I think it would mark double negatives.
Of course it would.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very standard.
It marks the passive even, like... So I was reading this book by Anne Curzon, who's also here at the LSA annual meeting, and she's got this book about, like, the history of standardizing English, Fixing English, I think it's called, about the history of English standardization, and one of her chapters is about, like, questioning the authority of Microsoft Word to underline your words, like, by what right and by whose rules do you get to underline this?
Yes.
And people who... think a lot about, you know, she surveyed her colleagues in the English department, and, you know, even though they have advanced English degrees, they'd never thought about, like, where does Microsoft Word get its ideas?
Yeah.
And what kind of outdated and never correct in the first place grammar stereotypes is it perpetuating?
Very good. We should read that.
Yeah, we should.
We should talk to her, too.
Well,
I mean, you should just talk to her anyway.
Yes.
I know.
She's on the list.
She's definitely on the list.
But yeah, no, it's something that interests me as an internet linguist, I guess, because looking at, like, Twitter data of, like, what are people saying on Twitter and how are people using, you know, creative respellings to represent their speech more closely than a standardized representation does, which people
it's
definitely
like
do.
It's like a new era of early old English manuscripts where you could trace them to the region they were from because of the accent. Like, it just makes me so happy to read something and, like, feel connected to that person because they are doing a great kind of eye dialect impression of Australian English. Yeah. Which is so good.
Well, it makes me think of how I used to teach quote-unquote developmental English at a community college, and many of my students were African-American English speakers, and they would take the G off of words that, you know, the ing, which is very typical pattern in African-American English, but I was, like, expected to mark that as something that was incorrect.
Apparently that used to be, like, an affluent form of British English, to G-drop in, like, Southern English. And which just shows how, like, arbitrary the social values we impose on particular sounds.
And there's another one, too, because apparently, so English used to have two ings, one of which, or two things that have now become the modern ing ending. One of which was like a gerund, and one of which was like a noun. So like the one in thing and stuff like that. And even people who have, so like, I don't think anybody says thin for thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, even people who are really, really robust, quote unquote, G droppers.
Yeah.
Never drop it, quote unquote, drop it there.
Right.
So there's a thing that's going on that's grammatical about that. Yeah. And one of the endings, and I don't remember this exact story, but one of the endings was originally like E-N-D-E, ende. Oh. And so the in ending kind of reflects this historical ending that didn't have a G on it in the first place.
Interesting.
And so what people are doing has like really old roots in many dialects of English and just became stigmatized when the orthography switched to G, and there was this idea that like, oh, it should have this G because the G's there in the orthography.
Huh. That also reminds me of the ask axe thing, because the axe is older than ask.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like we have this idea that English was like that older varieties of English were just one thing because that's what was written down, but it was always multiple ways of of talking.
Yeah. As soon as you have more than one person.
And this dialect anxiety is, it's like, so there's this pronounced discourse in Australia of like American English is ruining Australian English and Australian English is becoming less Australian and more American. And the examples people point out are often things that were really transitory and didn't actually stick around. And no one ever points out that, like, so for example, we don't refer to lorries for things, like for trucks. Mm-hmm. So there are things that we've, and we don't, like, we refer to trousers as trousers and underwear as underwear, and pants are a form of trousers rather than a form of underwear. Whereas in British English, they're pants. So don't do what someone I know did once as an Australian and email your British employer and ask if there's a particular colour of pants they want you to wear. They'll be very confused about why you want a uniform for your underwear. But it speaks to this fact that, like, we do have a lot of things that we have in common with American English that we've never had in common with British English, really. And no one ever points to those as, like, American English is ruining Australian English.
Why is it always American English that's ruining English?
Well, I mean, this is this, like, thing, right, is this anxiety that we have about the cultural hegemony. And, like, we do have a lot more exposure to American English than Americans have to us, which is why Australian actors can go to work in America and do a tolerable job of an American accent.
Mm-hmm.
And Americans just have vowels all over the place because suddenly you have to unmerge all this stuff that you never knew was different anyway. You can pick a bad Australian accent so far away. It's great.
Canadian actors will have to, like, learn how to do an American accent. And, like, there's dialect coaches for that and stuff like that. But, like, nobody ever even tries to learn a Canadian accent properly because it's, like,
no, they just fake close enough. They just fake a raising. A North Dakotan accent.
But it's, like, and they get Canadian raising wrong and it drives me bananas.
Yeah, it's not that hard, guys.
Well, it is if you don't have the phonemes, probably.
But and they, you don't have the do, thousands right? of hours
well,
of exposure.
No, they don't have the diphthongs. Because, like, if, like, the about, they have and they have I, but they don't have that as a diphthong. And I don't know how to describe that to somebody
if I guess you don't have it. I guess that's true.
Like, so they're putting it as...
But some Americans have the I one and not the O.
Yeah.
And no American ever points out the I one, actually. They know they never hear mice as, like, funny, but they hear about as funny. And I always thought that was interesting. But I think it's because some Americans have the raising with the I and not the L.
Yeah, and I think it's, like, it's acquired, like, a stereotype.
You have it, too, sense. I think. Mm. Mice, as opposed to mice.
Oh, no.
So the thing that I learned, like, surprisingly late in life, that it was supposed to be I scream for ice cream, mm-hmm. and not no. I scream for ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. they're supposed to be that, like, it was created by someone for whom those are the same vowel.
Yeah.
But because I have Canadian raising in ice.
Hang on, can you do it again? Because they sound like the same vowel to me.
That's because you don't have Canadian raising.
But you do it, Canadian.
I scream for ice cream.
Okay.
It's slightly shorter and higher.
Right. I'm just going to have to believe you all.
We can show you the spectrogram.
That would be great.
Like, I even have high school.
High school. I mean, we have Australian English has pretty high vowels anyway. Okay. So high school is already pretty high.
No, that's not.
It's not as high as ours.
But how would you say the ice cream thing?
Ice cream for ice cream.
Yeah, it's almost the same.
It's almost the same. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ice cream for ice cream. Those are two vowels.
Ice cream for ice cream.
Yeah, no, you have different. The raising.
Yeah. yeah.
Dear vocal fries listeners, say ice cream for ice cream.
This is what linguists do when they get together.
Yeah. We're so nerdy. That's
yeah.
insane.
I love you get four accents in a room.
Yeah. That's the beginning of a terrible dream.
Hours of entertainment.
Like, I'm sorry, I was trying to pay attention to what you said, but I got distracted by your vowels.
Yeah. yeah. That's what we do. Yeah, don't go on dates with linguists.
Or maybe do if you like that.
Yeah.
If you're already a linguist, maybe not.
Would you date someone for their accent?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Oh, yeah.
Totally.
I feel like it's such a like linguists saying, oh, yeah, to that is definitely a different thing to people being like, I think French accents are sexy.
Right.
Linguists are like, oh, yeah, gonna get someone who's got some quality Canadian raising.
You merge these two vowels, and I've never seen someone merge that way before. Yeah.
Exactly. Literally everything is data.
But sure. you need to keep some of your friends and family members linguistically naive, because then when your grammaticality intuitions get shot because you've been thinking about for something too long, you mm-hmm. have to be able to go ask your roommate or something.
That's,
like,
yeah.
hey, can you say this
yeah.
for me just to make sure if it sounds
Having like lived now in the last 4 years, we've lived in Singapore, Southern England and Australia, and then working all the time as I do with you as a Canadian mm-hmm. and a bunch of American colleagues, like, especially lexical intuitions. I have mm-hmm. no intuitions about words anymore. I'm just like, I can't remember where I use that or if it's mm-hmm. normal. So
yeah, the dialect surveys were like, how do you pronounce this word? Like, is it leisure or leisure? I'm like,
depending on who I'm talking to. Yeah.
Both sound okay to me now. Like, yeah. I don't even know. In that case, I think it's leisure.
Now, you say aluminum, we say aluminium. You say centrifugal, we say centrifugal. You say leisure, we say lisure.
I don't know.
And a lot of stuff that I think of as a change in progress is actually, I just moved to a different region.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. It's like, yes. I moved to a different region and it's actually a change in progress. Like I yeah. moved, so I grew up in Nova Scotia and then I moved to Ontario for undergrad and then I moved to Montreal for grad school. In Montreal, I don't have a lot of pressures on my English because most of the English speakers that I interact with are, you know, from a variety of locations and have moved to Montreal or like, and like the Montreal English is also a bit pluricentric,
mm-hmm.
but Montreal French, so my French has gotten like very Quebec since I moved to Montreal, which is great. I've been trying to make it more Quebec because I'm like, why should I speak European French anyway? It's just because of the French cultural hegemony. Like, I'm Canadian, I should speak Quebec French.
Damn it.
Damn it.
And thanks to Nicole Rosen, I know that there's a difference.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the differences?
No.
Okay.
So now I say, instead of saying like, fuck. I wasn't expecting you to be saying French. If I'm saying like, instead of like, tu sais, I have like tse. So I have the frication yes. on nice. on the high vowels, which is really fun. I can't even do them non-fricated now. I used to do them non-fricated, but I can't do it.
It's been really great working with you and discovering, like, I did, just to kind of bring my own biases in here, I definitely had this view that, like, American English was all of North American mm-hmm. English, and I do tend to forget that you are also part of the Commonwealth. it's like a surprise I go and, like, same person's on the money,
yeah,
which is
true.
Problematic in other ways. But yes. I always, like, I've learned so much about Canadian English and just how
and a lot of Canadians orient towards a more British standard as a way of not seeming American.
Oh my gosh, yeah. can you tell, because we talked about this in our, well, we didn't talk about it in the colour episode, but we did an episode about the semantics of different colour terms.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it came, I was like, oh no, Gretchen, we have to write the episode description and like who's color spelling are we going to use, because I use C-O-L-O-U-R She's definitely spelled correctly just then. And
I was like, no, I have O-U-R, because you know, labor and color and favor and favorite.
I did not know that about Canadian English, but it's a thing that...
So we've decided kind of for the podcast, like all our descriptions are like our house style is Canadian/Australian, which is basically like whatever we think it is, because we don't have adequate spell checks for it. And so just like whoever's writing it writes it the way they want to, and that's how we do it. And we ran into some... controversy about this because we made t-shirts and mugs and stuff with not judging your grammar, just analyzing it on them, because this is a common linguist sentiment that we have to correct.
And I didn't even think about it when we did it, but we obviously spelled analyze with an S.
And since then, we've gotten a bunch of people, you know, Americans being like, but do you have one with a Z or with a Z on it? And we're like, no. Doesn't have to be about you.
No,
like if you can't wear a shirt with an S on it, like
especially
you don't
that, especially
to wear this shirt.
That shirt of all shirts. Like if you can't be non-judgy on a mug
that says
you're
not
judgy, then you don't get the mug.
Like you missed the entire point of this exercise. And I think we would have faced a lot less flack if we had done the Z spelling.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh, for sure.
Because like. People who aren't Americans are more used to the world not catering.
I was going to say, Americans expect things to be the way that we want them to be.
Well, also in this case, I would spell this with a Z as well.
I would have spelled it with a Z too, but Lauren had made it with the S, and I was fine. Like, I'm not changing it. Yeah. Like, it's fine.
Yeah,
yeah no, I would have spelled it with a Z, but I was like, I'm amused by this. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
I just, it's one of the times I didn't think about it.
Yeah, no, and I figured it would be an interesting conversation piece, and once people were like, well, you could make both versions, and I was like, I don't think you see the point of, like, you know, here's our house style. It is whatever we say it is, and maybe it's not your style, but you're wearing this as a way of participating in a particular type of thing, and we're trying to, like, not make the podcast too American in a world where a lot of media is centered around the U.S.
Yeah. We love you, American listeners.
We say this in the U.S., like, we
with
like
love.
American listeners, but we want to expose them to things outside of, of their...
We have the advantage where I am American, so we can just say it, and our listeners can assume that I don't really mean everything
You know, and it's very easy because, like, you know, especially as a Canadian, I go to a lot of American conferences. I have a lot of American colleagues who I like very much. But it's you know, it's very easy to start, you know, getting in that pattern of like, you know, everything's...
Yeah, even when I was in elementary school, we were allowed to spell words the Canadian way or the American way.
Yeah.
Was it you telling me the anecdote about Z and Z and flipping?
There's a thing that happens that Jack Chambers, who's a Canadian linguist, has documented, where Canadian children will generally sing the alphabet song with Z at the end.
No, I never did.
Like a lot of them. I should have done a test on it for you. Anyway, like, Carrie, how did you sing the alphabet song? Canadian children will often sing the alphabet song with Z at the end. And they'll often say Z at the end when they're reciting the alphabet up until around the age of like 10 to 16. And then they switch to Z, which is a weirdly late age for acquisition stuff.
It must look like it's changed.
And so it looks like it's change in progress. It looks like the kids are just, you know, becoming Americanized and watching Sesame Street and like adopting this thing. Except you can keep doing it. Like, a decade later or 2 decades later, and still the little kids are using Z, but the 20-somethings who were your teenagers and your little kids have now switched to Z. So, like, my mom, when she was a kid, I asked her, she would have said Z, and now she says Z. When I was a kid, I sang the alphabet song with Z, and then I switched to Z.
Okay, I know why I didn't. My mother would have yelled at me.
Yeah. So once people acquire it as an identity token, they switch to Z and they're very adamant about it. And I, like, almost, I wouldn't admit that I had ever used a Z because, like, that's this thing that distinguishes us from those people.
Sometimes language contact can drive change apart as well as change towards.
Yeah, because they did this study on, I think it was Buffalo and... Windsor, Ontario? Buffalo, where's Buffalo?
New York.
That's right. No, but that's not next to Windsor. Anyway,
two places.
Two cities.
Niagara.
Is Niagara, St. Catharines. No, but it's like...
Yeah, the St. Catharines is right there.
What's on the U.S. side then?
Buffalo is like right on the border.
Buffalo?
Yeah,
oh,
it's right on the border.
Buffalo. Okay, great.
None of this means anything to me. Yeah.
Buffalo, Buffalo, Buffalo.
Yeah, that's what I thought you guys were talking about. I hate that sentence.
No, so those two cities, they've done like linguistic dialect surveys in them. And people, they actually talk more differently from each other than people who are further in from the border.
Mm.
Because people really want to identify, like, where they're from.
That's interesting.
I guess I should be the American and ask what the fuck Zed is.
Who's Zed?
Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead.
It's the last letter of the alphabet.
So it's a synonym.
Yes. Yeah. It's just our name for it versus your name for it.
Okay.
And yeah. It's like, I don't know, like pop versus soda or something.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, it's just other names for it. Like, most of the letters of the alphabet only have the one name, but this one, it has two.
All right. Because I heard you say Zed, and I was like, that's just how you say Z so that everyone understands that you're saying Z.
But you have it as, like, a disambiguation, like, international phonetic alphabet, or not, like, the NATO alphabet thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
I've never encountered that use. That's interesting.
Me either.
It's like saying zero instead of O on the phone or something for you.
Yep. Yeah.
Or
yep.
like Alpha Bravo Charlie Delta.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
yeah.
M as in Michael type thing.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was.
Huh. I didn't realize anybody did that.
The Z of the NATO phonetic alphabet is Zulu. Just
yeah,
if you were
yeah.
curious.
Yeah. So they don't have Z. They could have like Zeta or something there, but I don't know. They don't.
Yeah.
Because Z comes from like Greek Zeta and it got
changed over time.
Anyway, I don't know. I think more of our letters should have like real names for them rather than just like the sound followed by E, because then we wouldn't have this phone problem in the first place. But
it's true. But it is kind of fun to have like this code.
It does make it easy for the alphabet song to rhyme.
Yes.
I tried to write an alphabet song in IPA once and it did not go well because nothing rhymed.
Yeah.
And also the stress was very difficult.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, P, B, T, D, K, G, gloss top. And then it was like, do you say the name of the sound or do you say like the sound itself, like the name
yeah.
of the symbol? Because like some of the stuff, like even linguists using a P will generally just say P.
Yeah.
But like glottal stop, like, doesn't have a name other than glottal stop.
Yeah.
So it did not go well.
No. I can imagine.
I just got worried for you guys. Are you going to the thing?
The word of the year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so do we have like a last thing
okay.
that you want to...
We want to...
Like, what do you want to tell our listeners?
While you're thinking about that, I'm going to say that I'm an American, so I didn't think about these as issues. I'm so sorry. I was like, the keyboard and the spell check works for me. Never thought about how it wouldn't work for other dialects.
Well,
of even American
you
English.
Succeeded at not being an asshole.
Thank you. I was being an asshole before.
That's like, that's the thing is, I don't necessarily want to ensure that everyone does spell things a certain way, although my
no, right.
way would obviously be preferable. but just, you know, and it's just one of those things, like, we, in Australia, like, life goes on, even though I did read a bunch of books that had American spellings, and there's, like, even lexical items, like, when I was a kid, like, I still don't really know what pumps are or bangs are, but they were in the Babysitter's Club books, and so, like, we just got on with lexical variation and like those things are actually really common things, but I don't really have a visual for them in my head, but I do. It's a very specific like Babysitter's Club aesthetic and like and I think like allowing more people to have more of that exposure then makes them more open-minded about so like we get exposed to a lot of American and British accents on television and a lot of lexical variation. And I think when Australians travel, they do a better job of adapting to that variation they're exposed to. And so I think just exposing...
Whereas I have, like, a difficult time with your vowels because I don't have any Australian media that I've been exposed to since a young age.
You should have watched more Neighbours, Gretchen.
I didn't watch Neighbours, but I watched Home and Away a lot.
I watched Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries.
Good one. That's good.
It's pretty good, but that was, like, much later.
Yeah. But, yeah, and I think... I was just thinking, because we're going to be heading to the Word of the Year vote, there is no one declares a Canadian Word of the Year at the moment. So that's something that has been kind of on my radar, because we did a Word of the Year episode last year, mm-hmm. and I was like, you know, the Australian National Dictionary had done that, and I thought, geez, no one...
We have the Australian National Dictionary and Macquarie.
Do they each declare a Word of the Year?
Yeah, they do, yeah.
Oh, good for them.
Yeah.
So there are two Australian Word of the Years. There's a bunch of, like, American ones.
Mm-hmm. No Canadian.
And there's no Canadian Word of the Year. Mm. I'm like, we've got to get somebody on that, Carrie. Let's do this.
And the British, of course, have the Oxford Dictionary, which just presumes to name the Word of the Year for everyone.
Yeah, right.
As they do.
So it's not necessarily about changing your English or the way you spell or the way you use words, but just being open to exposing yourself to podcasts by people who don't speak the same accent as you. And it is a bit harder at the start, but it's really worthwhile.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah, and even just accepting that more languages can be pluricentric, and standardization isn't an inherent good when it comes to language.
It's definitely not.
It's, in fact, terrible.
Yeah.
I think that's what Americans should take away, as I'm hearing y'all. That we should think about how so much of the media we don't have to worry about fitting in when it comes to that.
Or standardizing, like just accepting that Harry Potter was written in British English. I mean,
yeah,
that's
but
a whole
then they
other...
switched things.
Yeah, they did.
We got the British versions, though, so I had to deal with trainers, and I didn't know what a trainer were. And then, like, so I was like, I guess there's just things that Harry Potter wears. And I was like, oh, you mean sneakers. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, we called them runners where I grew up.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a runners person as well.
Oh, nice.
These nice commonalities across countries.
Commonwealth present.
But I'm a sneakers person because I'm from the Maritimes.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, there's all this stuff, and I think, like... And I think having space for multiple different varieties of speaking, even within something that we call a language, is something that there mm-hmm. isn't enough attention to.
Agreed. Well, I think that's a good place to end.
Sounds like a great place to end.
So thanks for being our guests.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Yeah, awesome. we had to take this opportunity.
All right. Well, thanks again, and don't be an asshole.
You say basil, we say basil, and you say herbs, and we say herbs, because there's a fucking H in it. But you spell through, T-H-R-U, and I'm with you on that, because we spell it thruff. And that's trying to cheat at Scrabble. How can we get that oo sound? Well, a U will work. What about an O as well? No, we don't need it, we're fine. No, I think an O in. Well, all right. And a G as well. What? Yes, a G would be good. Yes, we need a silent G just in the background in case of any accidents or something. Well, all right. And an H as well. Fucking hell, hang on. An H in case some herbs come along. All right. And a Q and a P and a Z. Look, it's a word in Scrabble that's 480 points.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by Chris Ayers for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com.